It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Great Lakes Compact was signed into law on this date 10 years ago. We'll talk about the law and new challenges facing the Great Lakes today. First, it's time for a weekly look at the top political news from the nation's capital. The FBI is nearing the end of its investigation into sexual assault allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Democratic Representative Keith Ellison of Minnesota is campaigning to be the state's attorney general despite claims of domestic violence. Plus, both President Trump and the chair of the Federal Reserve are praising the state of the U.S. economy, something that would normally be a big plus for Republicans on the campaign trail. You can weigh in on our question of the week: is the health of the economy a major voting issue for you? If you're a Republican, do you wish GOP candidates would focus more on the current economy than they do? If you're an independent, does the direction of the economy influence your vote? Or do you think that political polarization has made issues like the economy take a backseat to more negative messaging, attack ads? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Amanda Turkle joins us now, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the big stories people are following, the FBI apparently wrapping up pretty soon this investigation into allegations of sexual assault against Brett Kavanaugh. A lot of confusion this week over the scope of the investigation, who's going to be interviewed and who's not. What do we know, and I guess not know, about this FBI investigation?
Well, it looks like that, as of now, Christine Blasey Ford and Brett Kavanaugh, sort of the two main players in this, are not going to be interviewed by the FBI at the request of the White House. And Ford has said that she wants to be interviewed. Actually, just a few minutes before our conversation, her legal team sent out a letter responding to a request for some documents and said, like, we're happy to provide them, but she wants to be interviewed by the FBI. After all, she was one of the people who requested the FBI investigation. You know, Republicans have said that there's no need to talk to them because they have already testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. They should have told the committee everything. And the White House said, like, look, if senators have more questions for them, they should have asked. They had their chance to ask them. But they are interviewing people who are supposedly witnesses, people like Mark Judge, who Christine Blasey Ford has said was present during her sexual assault by Kavanaugh. But it seems like there are a lot more people out there who say they have information that could corroborate Ford's allegations or maybe help Kavanaugh, but it doesn't seem like the FBI's investigation is going to get everyone.
You wrote a recent piece looking at an FBI investigation into harassment claims by Anita Hill during the Clarence Thomas confirmation back in 1991. How did the results of that investigation factor into that confirmation process?
Well, it's important to realize that the FBI investigation is sort of what it isn't. It isn't a criminal investigation. It's not going to be that broad. It's a background check, and it has its value. You know, people, you would think, would be less likely to lie to the FBI, and you'll have these neutral investigators writing up a report and then giving their assessment on the situation. But it's not a criminal investigation. People shouldn't think that it will be. And when Anita Hill was interviewed by the FBI, and the FBI did an investigation into her allegations against Clarence Thomas, it ends up their investigation wasn't that thorough. They didn't talk to her for very long. They didn't ask her a lot of questions and get a lot of details about what happened. And when she testified, she gave far more detail, and the FBI ended up looking pretty bad because they didn't do their job fully enough. So they ended up throwing her under the bus, implying that she embellished later on because she didn't tell them everything. So in other words, this FBI investigation, it's not the end-all be-all. It doesn't mean that Kavanaugh is finished. It could just end up being used as cover for senators who can then say, well, there was an FBI investigation. I'm now going to vote for him.
And we're going to be watching for what the Senate ends up doing. And some in the Senate are watching what President Trump is saying. He'd ordered this investigation, but people had said, oh, he's being surprisingly measured about Christine Blasey Ford, at least last week. Now, here he is at a rally last night talking about, and people say mocking, Christine Blasey Ford and her testimony. Here's a listen.
36 years ago, this happened. I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know.
What kind of reaction is that getting from some key Senate Republicans who people think may be on the fence on the confirmation?
The reaction is not good. You had Susan Collins say that she didn't like what the president said. And you had a lot of other Republicans, including his own supporters, say you shouldn't be doing that. Lindsey Graham, for example, a Republican from South Carolina, said, like, look, that's not helpful. Many of Trump's supporters, his allies around him in the White House and in the Senate, have really, really wanted him to stay quiet on this. They don't see any benefit in him attacking Christine Blasey Ford, who many people, even Republicans and Republican women who, you know, obviously are sort of an independent women who are key to the midterm elections, they really sympathize with Ford. And to have Trump out there mocking this woman who went public with this very emotional testimony about what she went through, it's not a look that many people in the party want to have.
We're looking at some of the top stories in national politics with Amanda Turkel from the Huffington Post. We'll be talking more about the Kavanaugh confirmation process, by the way, and take your calls tomorrow afternoon at 4:30. I want to move on to this issue of the economy, and I want to give a listen to Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell talking about good news about the state of the economy. President Trump has been talking about that, too. Here's Jerome Powell talking yesterday.
Unemployment is near 50-year lows, and inflation is roughly at our 2% objective. And that the baseline outlook of many forecasters, inside and outside the Fed, is for more of the same. This historically rare pairing of steady low inflation and very low unemployment is a testament to the fact that we remain in extraordinary times.
So Republicans are in power. We're seeing some good economic news here. Are Republicans talking about this a lot on the campaign trail as they run for Congress?
A little bit. Not as much as you would think, but they are talking about it. We recently looked at the ads that Republicans are running, and the tax bill is something that you hear Republicans say, you know, over and over, that this is our big legislative achievement. But if you look at the campaign ads, they are not mentioning the tax bill itself all that much. They're talking about the issue of taxes. You know, Democrats want to raise your taxes. They don't support lowering them, things like that. But the tax bill itself does not get as many mentions. I mean, the economy, traditionally, when the economy is good, the president will do well. But the economy, a strong economy, just isn't enough to pull Republicans through the midterms this time. It's in part because, you know, the stock market is booming, for example. But workers aren't seeing their wages go up. They're not seeing their hours reduced. It's just not trickling down as much to average workers. And also this election, it's just not as much about issues. It's much more about how people feel about, you know, what Trump is doing, the partisanship in the country, and sort of how Congress is doing it overall. There are just bigger things sort of going on here.
We invited our listeners to join in on this, 800-642-1234. How important an issue is the economy in this election to you? How important should it be? We'll go now to Dave on the line in Rhinelander. Dave, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I would say I'm a Democrat, but I think this whole thing with the economy doing well does not reflect what the population's doing. It reflects what the corporations are doing. The tax cuts did not go back to increased wages. It went to buybacks of stock, which is good for the investors, but in the investors, typically the ones that hold the largest number of stock shares are wealthy, who are getting the benefit of the tax cuts anyway. The other thing that's going on is that with all the tariffs, prices on goods are going up, and it does not take into account how well the population's doing, the cost of living. And
Dave,
I think that's disingenuous.
Dave, thanks a lot for calling in. Amanda, Dave hitting on something that I think some polling has suggested too, including I think a Republican internal poll saying that the tax cuts aren't polling that well in the public. That may be part of why they're not running on the specific tax cuts in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dave is right. I mean, the tax cuts, I think that people more and more realize that the tax cuts really benefited corporations. That's why in the tax bill, the the tax cuts for corporations were permanent and the tax cuts for individuals expire. And the House has passed legislation to make them permanent for individuals, but that's not going anywhere in the Senate. And, you know, the argument is if that was so important to them, why didn't they do that initially? You know, there was that initial burst of sort of good publicity of companies saying that we're giving our employees bonuses or whatever because of the tax bill, but that has largely stopped. People have seen that their wages haven't really changed, and they're just not seeing much from this tax bill and all the benefits they're supposedly going to get. And we've seen already in special elections where Republicans tried to run on the tax bill. It just wasn't a message that people were buying. It was still seen as legislation that helped corporations. And so that's a real problem for Republicans. They don't really have a legislative achievement that's popular with the public.
We're talking to Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post, about this week's news in politics. You can join in. You can still let us know what you think about the role of the economy on the campaign trail in these politically polarized times. Do you think economic issues matter as much as they used to? If you're a Republican, do you think GOP candidates are talking enough about what looks like a strong economy, at least by many measures? Can the state of the economy swing your vote? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post, looking at the week in national politics. We asked you what you thought about the economy as a political issue in the midterm elections. We heard from Dana in Green Bay, who said the economy should be a major factor in midterm voting. There's many positives in the economy people should pay attention to. Amanda, I want to follow up on a point you brought up earlier. The U.S. House, you mentioned, passed this extension, this making permanent of those individual tax cuts. As you said, the Senate doesn't look like they're going to pick that up at all. Is this an opportunity, though, for Republicans to run on, see, we passed your individual tax cuts, and to put Democrats on the spot voting for or against that?
I think that's what they're hoping. That's obviously why they passed it. But again, I think that Democrats have a pretty easy rebuttal of, well, why didn't you do that to begin with? This bill isn't going to go anywhere. You know, why were they looking out for corporations and they'd only worry about passing your tax cuts and making them permanent later in this individual bill, which is harder to pass? So, you know, again, from what I've seen, Republicans, there have been some Republicans talking about the tax legislation, but overall, it's just not something they're running on. They just know it's not popular. So when they do talk about taxes, it's much vaguer about Democrats not supporting tax cuts or wanting to raise your taxes. You know, there are issues that the public feels very strongly about this election cycle. Healthcare is very, very high on the list. Republicans for years ran on repealing Obamacare. And this is the first cycle since Obamacare passed that Democrats are running more ads on it because Obamacare has gotten more popular and people don't want to see it repealed. But that's not what's driving people to the polls, just as people may like tax cuts, but it's not driving them to polls. It's this more, sort of a larger issue of the political atmosphere, sort of how they feel about their candidates and Trump and the general political the general political atmosphere, I would say, more than individual issues and the change they want to see in the country.
Want to take one more call on the politics of the economy. Dan is with us in Wautoma. Dan, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I think that while your caller or your guest does have some valid points, I think we're painting with a rather large brush, saying that only corporations have to deal, the big corporations. Many companies that are regulated at the 100 to 500 employee rate have got those tax breaks and are expanding and have reduced the unemployment rate by being not losing business, not losing customers, but by expanding their operations to the point where our unemployment rate is at the lowest level in 50 years. The other thing is to say that, you know, wages are stagnant. Well, that's also not really accurate because there are GAO and other numbers out there that say wages are rising. So rising at the rate everybody would like? Probably not. But going backwards, stagflation, inflation, those are things that have been avoided by these tax plans.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. Dan pointing to good news he sees, and Republicans, I mean, the unemployment number alone is something that Republicans could be trying to run on.
In a traditional election, they definitely would be. But it's still the fact that a lot of people aren't seeing their wages and their quality of life change as dramatically as Trump sort of trumpets when he is on the campaign trail. You know, Democrats also, when they talk about the tax bill, talk about the immense deficit created by it and sort of warning that Republicans are going to target cuts in Social Security and Medicare to pay for it. You know, this is especially because Republicans for so long talked, sort of hit Democrats for not paying enough attention at reducing the deficit. It's just, you know, like I said, this election cycle, the economy and the state of the economy, and as much as Trump wants to take credit for it, it is just not the driving issue. And it's not enough to motivate people to get out to the polls necessarily.
Thanks for that call, Dan. We're talking to Amanda Turkel from the Huffington Post, looking at some of the big issues in national politics. I want to move on to a couple other stories now. It's got a national angle and relevant to our neighbors to the west in Minnesota. U.S. Representative Keith Ellison, a Democrat running for attorney general in Minnesota, has been under investigation by an attorney hired by the Democratic Party in that state for allegations of domestic abuse. Can you bring us up to date on that story?
Sure. Well, I mean, it's really hurting Ellison's reelection bid. I mean, Congressman Ellison, sort of a rising star in the Democratic Party, this progressive superstar, and he's running for attorney general. But he has this domestic abuse allegation hanging over him. And the party hired someone to independently look at it. And she found that the biggest allegation in there that he sort of dragged her off their bed while shouting profanity at her in 2016, that just couldn't be substantiated. The woman, Karen Monahan, an ex-girlfriend of Keith Ellison's, has said that she has video, but she hasn't produced it, and she sort of keeps changing explanations for why. But there are still questions of whether, you know, in their relationship, there was maybe emotional abuse, verbal abuse, things like that. So, you know, the report sort of got him out of the worst allegation and said that there just wasn't enough evidence for it, but it's still hanging over him in this sort of Me Too movement, and it's still something that his Republican colleagues are using against him, and that makes many Democrats uneasy with his candidacy.
And former President Obama had released a bunch of new endorsements in races around the country. I think this is one he did not issue an endorsement in, noticeably.
Which is surprising, you know, people were very excited when Keith Ellison said that he was going to be running for attorney general. Right now, attorneys general around the country are sort of at the front edge of hitting back at President Trump. Keith Ellison was known as a congressman as being incredibly aggressive, outspoken, a progressive champion. And so this seemed like a good role for him, somewhere where he could maybe do a little bit more than being in Congress. But now it's just, you know, Democrats are not only worried about his candidacy and losing the attorney general seat to a Republican, but what effect he could have on other candidates.
And I want to turn to now a kind of a more abstract notion of the pace of national news lately, Amanda. Was it just 2 or 3 weeks ago we were all trying to figure out who wrote that anonymous op-ed, some Trump administration official? The Bob Woodward book was the game changer that we were all going to be talking about for weeks and months to come. Now, so many other things have happened since then. Of course, the Kavanaugh confirmation, President Trump's comments yesterday, this New York Times piece that we haven't even talked about on Donald Trump's financial history. One story crowds out another story really fast lately.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I completely forgot about that anonymous New York Times.
Right, that was the huge thing.
And then how every reporter would supposedly be spending their time trying to unmask that person, and it's now been sort of forgotten. But, I mean, it's just crazy. In any other administration, I feel like one of these stories would just be a giant scandal, or what President Trump said about the deaths because of the hurricane in Puerto Rico. You know, any other, that would just be such a big scandal. And now, you know, we've all moved on from it. And so Trump in many ways is sort of benefiting from the chaos and the constant churning news cycle of the news about what's going on, that people can't keep their attention in one place. and can't really dig in on one thing. But the Kavanaugh thing seems like it's going to be sticking around, although Republicans are trying to push it through as quickly as possible.
Does it feel like in reporting on Congress and national politics, do you get to sense the people you're reporting about are feeling this sense of chaos, of this fast-moving chain of events?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you frequently ask lawmakers on Capitol Hill about something, and they're like, I haven't even seen it yet. Or they sort of roll their eyes and they're like, I can't keep up with it. I mean, senators especially don't really like dealing with all the chaos coming out of the White House, because then they're asked by reporters to respond to it, and it's not necessarily what they want to be dealing with either. I'm sure they would much love to be talking about the tax bill and the economy and things like that and what they have going on in Congress, but instead they have to respond to the president's tweets or something he says at a rally. So it's completely, you know, Washington is just very different than it was during the Obama and Bush years.
Is there a sense that this is how it's going to be forever, or is this maybe how it's going to be during the Trump administration, however long that might last, another 2 or 6 years, whatever?
Definitely during the Trump years. Whether this continues, that is a big question that everyone wonders, and I don't know. It might depend on who the next president is.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Amanda, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Amanda Turkle. She's the Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post. She was with us for a look at some of the week's top political news. Still time for you to weigh in on our question this week. How important is the economy for you as an issue in the November midterm elections? You can tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can always tweet us at Central Time WPR. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you think. On October 3rd, 2008, President George W. Bush signed the Great Lakes Compact into law. 8 states along the Great Lakes, including Wisconsin, signed onto the agreement, which dictated how the water would be managed. The 10 years since its signing, the Great Lakes Compact has faced some issues, and our next guest is here to talk about how the law has fared over the decade and what might challenge the agreement moving forward. Peter Annan is co-director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College and author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, which is coming out this fall in a new edition. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start with some news that, as far as I can tell, broke because of this new edition of your book, information about a diversion plan for water that was really under the radar. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so back before the compact was adopted, under a prior water regulation mechanism called the Water Resources Development Act of 1986. Pleasant Prairie in extreme southeast Wisconsin on the shore of Lake Michigan had received a diversion of water for 3.2 million gallons per day. And that sort of sat there for years and years. And then the Great Lakes Compact gets adopted, as you said, in 2008. And one of the things that the states throughout the Great Lakes region had to do was report in to the Council of Great Lakes Governors and the Compact Council what existing diversions they already had and at what level, so that those could be grandfathered in under the compact. And when Wisconsin reported the Pleasant Prairie diversion, it tripled, more than tripled the amount from 3.2 million gallons per day to 10.69 million gallons per day.
And this was in the last year of the Doyle administration. Do we know why they tripled the allowance for Pleasant Prairie?
Yeah, so Wisconsin has an interesting statute that requires that the water delivery pipes need to match up geographically with the sewage pipes, so that the water that is delivered to a community marries up with the water that takes with the plumbing that takes the dirty water away. And it turns out that Pleasant Prairie has a really large sewage system that needed to be matched by the delivery water. And so the state officials used that law as the reason to dramatically expand the Pleasant Prairie water diversion. But they reported that data, but they didn't publicly announce that data. And the amount that was increased in Pleasant Prairie exceeds the water diversion amount that Foxconn and Racine have applied for. And it's almost the amount that Waukesha got in 2016 in its water diversion application. So it's a significant increase in water. And that actually made Pleasant Prairie the largest municipal water diversion in the state, but nobody knew other than some officials at the DNR.
Yeah, under the spirit of the compact, is this something that should have, you know, the case should have been made to the other states in the compact?
Yeah, and it's really interesting. Sort of the region is still kind of processing this news. Some environmental organizations are consulting some attorneys trying to figure it out. The state is quite confident that what they did was legal. But yeah, as you said, there have been a lot of questions about the spirit of the compact and the transparency. And the compact has really been an extraordinarily transparent document when it was being negotiated, when it was being adopted by the eight Great Lakes states Congress and signed by the president. There was a lot of really impressive transparency here, and the environmental organizations are sort of telling me that, you know, look, we didn't think to check baseline, because baseline seems like it's the baseline. Why would anybody change the baseline? So they've been caught a bit off guard, and the region, the governor's office in Michigan, said it's going to be reviewing things. And so, again, the news is just a couple weeks old since the book first came out, and so everyone's still processing it. But it's. I think we're going to hear a little bit more about Pleasant Prairie going forward.
Yeah, we'll be watching for developments. Let's take a step back now and talk about the compact more generally. What was the main goal of the Great Lakes Compact?
Yeah, so for decades and decades, there has been a fear that as the water situation in the United States and globally becomes more and more stressed, that there'll be increased global, regional, continental pressure on water-rich regions of the world, like the North American Great Lakes. So the compact was designed as what I call a legal water fence to keep Great Lakes water inside the Great Lakes Basin, so that the jobs come to the water rather than sending the water to the jobs somewhere else, agriculture, cities, etc.
And how far can we take water out of the Great Lakes? And there's some little gray areas, and the Waukesha story is part of that, but how much is diversion limited?
Yeah, so there are two key exception clauses in the Great Lakes Compact, and those are exception clauses for communities that straddle, sit right on top of that Great Lakes Basin line, that soup bowl rim of a watershed that surrounds the five North American Great Lakes. And then there's also a straddling county exception clause for communities that are in counties that straddle the basin line, but the communities themselves are clean and clear outside the Great Lakes Basin. And so those straddling county applicants, which is what Waukesha was, have a much higher bar than the straddling community applicants, which is an example would be New Berlin outside of Milwaukee. Is that the straddling community applicants only need the approval of the local state, but Waukesha and other straddling county applicants need the approval of all eight Great Lakes governors, which is a super high bar. You got to have all the approval from Minnesota to New York.
Talking to Peter Annan, author of The Great Lakes Water Wars, about the Great Lakes Compact on the 10th anniversary of it being signed into law, and diversion efforts that have gone on in the last 10 years and those of the future, too. Peter, one that's got a lot of attention, you already mentioned it earlier, is the Foxconn, this huge corporate industrial development with its own diversion request. Can you put that in the context of the Great Lakes Compact?
Sure. And the Foxconn proposal really also was surprising to a lot of people, because the authors of the compact had told me that they didn't really envision a giant 13,000 employee facility actually straddling the Great Lakes Basin line. So we've talked about straddling communities, we've talked about straddling counties. Well, the Foxconn situation brought up a straddling corporation. It literally, the facility, which is going to be the size of three Pentagons, is sort of partially inside the Great Lakes watershed and partially out of it. Because it's partially out of it, it required, it was needed a water diversion application. It's located in the community of Mount Pleasant, which is just west of Racine. Mount Pleasant doesn't have its own water supply system. It gets its water from Racine. Thereby, Racine applies for the water diversion on behalf of Mount Pleasant, which is in part applying on behalf of Foxconn. And so that sort of stirred things up in new ways, because there's a debate going on and a legal challenge now, which was filed in May, asking the question whether or not water was meant to be diverted for corporations, because there's language in the compact that says the water really is for public water supply purposes, primarily residential in nature.
Now, we hear about the volume of water that goes to some of these projects we're talking about, and, millions of gallons, which sounds like a lot. Does a diversion like the Waukesha one or the Foxconn plan, compared to the volume of the Great Lakes, do they really make that much of a difference?
Yeah, they do not. And you're right. Those numbers sound like they're big, 7 to 8 million gallons per day. But you know, if you have 6 quadrillion gallons in the Great Lakes, which is a number that's so large it's hard for people to wrap their head around it. But these diversions we're talking about would really be immeasurable if somebody tried to measure the impact that they would have on the Great Lakes. And it's important to remember that one of the key changes that the Great Lakes brought, the Great Lakes Compact brought to the water diversion debate, is that it requires that this water all be returned to the Great Lakes after it's cleaned to Clean Water Act standards and discharged to the water body. So the idea there'd be really no net loss under these water diversions. And but throughout the history of the Great Lakes water diversion debate and concern, it's never really been about any one water diversion creating damage in and of itself to the Great Lakes water levels. It's the fact that there could be precedent that could be set that could sort of lead to sort of a death or destruction by a thousand straws, if you will, that there's some kind of camel's nose gets in into the process and then creates a legal precedent by which it could be expanded by future diversions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But again, the Great Lakes Compact with this, you know, just only allowing water diversions, all of which have to be returned for communities on or near the Great Lakes Basin Line, really rein things in. And because if you're not a community that's on the basin line or just outside it, you can't even request a Great Lakes water diversion. So the lakes really have never before been better protected. And what we see after 10 years of the Great Lakes Compact is, you know, we're working into new areas, the documents being tested, the legal mechanism is being tested. And it's, you know, it's like I at a conference at Marquette University yesterday, I sort of referred to it as a 10-year-old child. It's not even a teenager yet. And it's normal for these complex environmental pieces of legislation to sort of work things through over time.
We're talking to Peter Annan right now, co-director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College and author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. He's with us to talk about the 10 years of the Great Lakes Compact and challenges facing Great Lakes the Great Lakes Water Basin today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the Great Lakes Compact and how it works? What do you think about laws regulating the Great Lakes? Do you worry about diversions to places like Waukesha or the Foxconn plant, or if you're in Waukesha itself, are you glad that things have worked out to allow you to use that water? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the Great Lakes Compact on the 10th anniversary of its signing into law. Peter Annan is with us, co-director of the Mary Griggs Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation at Northland College and author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think the Great Lakes should be managed? Should companies like Foxconn be able to draw water out of the lakes? How about cities on that Great Lakes Basin, just on the other side maybe of a county from that basin? Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hello.
Hi. I wonder, well, what about paying for cleaning up? Because I've heard many times about Milwaukee's sewer system spewing out sewage into Lake Michigan. And, well, how is that being cleaned up, or is it being cleaned up, and who pays for that?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Peter, water, not quantity here, but quality.
Yeah, and the compact just is strictly related to water quantity and diversions and things like that, and as a primary regulatory document. Secondarily, it does require, as I said, that any water that's withdrawn from the lake and used needs to be cleaned to Clean Water Act standards before it's returned. The Milwaukee situation is a very important one, as Dennis mentions, but Milwaukee's inside the Great Lakes Basin already, so it's really a water quality issue dealing with sewer system, and they've got their, you know, their deep tunnel that they're working on there, and a super important issue. But the issue of the compact is really a water quantity one, not a water quality one.
So for a city or a corporation, for that matter, emitting polluted water into the Great Lakes, that would be something in the U.S. that would be covered by the Clean Water Act, not by the Great Lakes Compact. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Michael in Bear Valley. Michael, hello.
Hello. Well, my question is similar. I was concerned about the quality of the water that goes back into the lake. And hello, are you there?
Yep. Keep going, Michael.
Okay. Yes. So, who determines? You said the Clean Air and Water Act has a say in that, but who actually will be monitoring the water that eventually, if it happens, comes out of Foxconn and goes back into the lake? Is it the is it a local community? Is it the DNR? Who is actually involved with that, and to what extent is science involved in the determination?
Michael, thanks for the call. So with that specific example of Foxconn needing to return that water that's been extracted, how does that work in terms of the water quality of what they return?
Yeah, great question. And these were also concerns with the Waukesha water diversion as well, which we didn't mention yet, but it's also being returned to the Great Lakes via a pipeline that then leads to the Root River and then outflows at the city of Racine. And so there's been a robust debate about that with water diversions. There have been concerns raised about it with Foxconn because of the industrial process. But to specifically answer Michael's question, is the DNR permitting and then also under the Federal Clean Water Act, so you have the federal government's Clean Water Act and then the state of Wisconsin enforcing the Clean Water Act on behalf of the federal government. If there's any case where the federal government thinks that Wisconsin is not doing an adequate job of enforcing those federal rules, then there is a process for the federal government to come in and take that over from the state. And there can be citizen suits that make that happen or appeals, et cetera. And so there's sort of a multi-layered process, but the permitting, the monitoring, that sort of thing is conducted by the Department of Natural Resources.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Peter, let's get at the Waukesha story. We've mentioned it briefly a couple times, but that has been maybe the biggest story of the Great Lakes Compact in the last 10 years. We've talked about it a lot. We've talked to you about it as it ran its course. But looking back now where we are, talk about that story and what it said about the Great Lakes Compact.
Yeah, well, Waukesha was the first major test case of the Great Lakes Compact. And as most of your listeners will probably remember, so you have a community of 70,000 people, roughly, and it's just slightly outside, a few miles outside the Great Lakes Basin. It's sitting on top of a depleted and naturally contaminated deep groundwater system, and naturally contaminated with radium, a naturally occurring radioactive element in the groundwater. So the city was under state and federal pressure to either clean up the water, find an alternate water source, et cetera. And so Waukesha eventually decided to apply for a Great Lakes water diversion in May of 2010. That was heavily vetted by the Department of Natural Resources for 5 years before the department felt it was ready to circulate with the other seven Great Lakes governors for approval. And then those governors spent 6 months reviewing Waukesha's water diversion application and changed it fairly significantly. They reined in the geographic scope of the diversion by about 50%, and they reduced the requested amount from 10.1 million gallons per day to 8.2 million gallons per day. And it was a close call there in the end. The state of Minnesota had the most concerns about the Waukesha water diversion. Again, all it takes is one state to say no, and Waukesha would have been out of luck. But in the end, Minnesota did join the other Great Lakes governors in approving the Waukesha water diversion for 8.2 million gallons per day. And so where we are right now is the city of Waukesha, which will be getting its water from the city of Milwaukee. And then again, as I mentioned earlier, returning it eventually via the Root River to Lake Michigan at Racine, is now sort of in the process of putting in that infrastructure, A, to get the water from Milwaukee, and then B, to return it by pipeline to the Root River and then have that flow upstream from the Root River down to Lake Michigan.
As you mentioned earlier, one worry is about, okay, if we approve this, whatever it is, Waukesha, Foxconn, does this set a precedent? Do we have other Waukeshas out there in these straddling counties making their applications now?
Yeah, and that was the concern. And yeah, just to be clear, so this does set precedent, but only for other Waukesha-like situations, other potential straddling county applicants. Waukesha's approval does not set a precedent for long-range far-flung diversions to some other state or country. And so No other straddling community applicants have stepped forward. You know, it took Waukesha something like, I don't know, $5 million and years and years and years. And so one of the questions is, was the process Waukesha went through so intimidating that we're not going to see any or not very many straddling county applicants stepping forward in the future? Or is there just not a burning need in any specific community that we've heard about yet? And so it's sort of a, you know, stay tuned situation. In the meantime, we've had more straddling community applications from, you know, with the Foxconn situation and the Racine application that was submitted earlier this year. So, and in the end, it turns out, and Wisconsin residents may not realize this, but Southeast Wisconsin is really a hot spot for water diversions. There are more water diversion hotspots in Southeast Wisconsin than all other Great Lakes states combined. And so when you haven't talked about the diversion at Chicago, which is the largest diversion in the Great Lakes and 100 years old, but you take the controversy in Chicago, the controversy in southeastern Wisconsin, that's what I call that front line in the Great Lakes water war, that sort of Milwaukee-Chicago megacity corridor. And again, we're going to hear Pleasant Prairie's in that area as well. So I think we're just going to continue to hear more and more about the water diversion issue here in Wisconsin for years to come.
Talking to Peter Annan, author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. Back to your calls now. Dan is with us in Madison. Dan, hello.
Hi. So I was just wondering, I know that this is like a United States agreement. How does Canada play into all this? Because I know they straddle a lot of the Great Lakes.
Yeah, Peter, Canada.
Yeah, and this gets complicated, but Canada has been right there shoulder to shoulder with the eight Great Lakes states on this. As Dan mentioned, the Great Lakes are an international boundary water, and the complexity was how with two provinces in a different country and then eight states here in the United States, we want to surround the entire Great Lakes basin with this legal paradigm that keeps Great Lakes water inside the Great Lakes. And so what happened was there's actually two agreements. I've only been talking about the Great Lakes Compact so far because that's generally what American audiences want to hear. But there's also agreements with Ontario and Quebec that implement the same rules and regulations on the Canadian side of the Great Lakes as the Great Lakes Compact has implemented in the eight states stretching from New York to Minnesota, thereby enveloping that whole international boundary water in the same rules and regulations. The only difference is that Canadian provinces do not have a veto authority over the eight Great Lakes states' water diversion applications. So the Canadians had a voice in Waukesha, but not a vote. And the same holds true in Canada, is that the eight Great Lakes governors can express their opinion about water diversion proposals in Canada, but in the end, the Canadians will make a decision on what happens on their side of the international border. It's a great question.
Thanks for that call, Dan. Very briefly, Peter, just a few seconds. Despite these concerns on the ground, overall, is this a successful agreement?
Yeah, I think the general sense is that the compact is working. I mean, some people aren't happy with some of the decisions that are made, but the process overall is working. I think even most of the critics of some of the decisions will agree with that. And in the end, that was the secret, was how are we going to set up a process to have this be, in an organized fashion, be judged by the governors and premiers in the Great Lakes region. And overall, I think things have held up pretty well.
Peter, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Peter Annan from Northland College. He's the author of The Great Lakes Water Wars. We've been talking about the 10-year anniversary of the Great Lakes Compact.
Traveling through another dimension, a dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind.
Yesterday was the anniversary of the 1959 debut of The Twilight Zone, and the creepifying show is coming back next year. CBS released its first tease for the new version of The Twilight Zone yesterday. Taking over for Rod Serling, who we just heard there as host and narrator, is Jordan Peele, known as half the comedy duo Key and Peele, and known as the director of the creepy horror movie Get Out. There have been a couple of reboots of the series in the past. The original show ran from 1959 through 1964, and more importantly to me, it ran in syndication well through my childhood. I watched it. I watched a lot. And I still, there are a couple episodes I have to not think too carefully about, or I'll get creeped out again, 30 plus years after seeing them. One, the line "going my way" sticks in my head, the hitchhiker episode. I won't spoil it. Go back and watch it, you know, with a friend during daytime. And one, this never shows up on lists of top 10 favorites, but this one sticks with me, a wax museum curator who brings some of the exhibits home with horrifying results. Let us know if you have a favorite Twilight Zone memory or least favorite. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @Central Time WPR. This is Central Time.